On Tech News Today, Sony's newest phone shows 4K videos in full resolution, but the next Apple TV can't. And a new restaurant in San Francisco replaces waiters with iPads. It's all coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Wednesday, September 2nd, 2015. This episode is brought to you by Intel. Small business owners can't afford to choose between A or B. If both help your business, you want A and B. With Intel-powered 2-in-1s, you get performance and mobility, power and freedom. That's the power of and. Experience it at smallbusiness.intel.com. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you all the ingredients to cook fresh, delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. My name is Mike Elgin. Our co-anchor today is ZDNet contributing writer Kevin Toefel. Hey, Kevin, how are you doing today?
I am doing well. I think I'm doing better than everybody in Berlin because the IFA show is going on there, and it's just chock full of news and devices and such.
Yeah, it's crazy. And what's interesting about the fact that IFA began today is that it didn't begin today. It begins on Friday. And so the clamoring to be first to announce stuff is like, you know, bleeding it into the week. And Asus like had an announcement, I think, at 1 o'clock in the morning or something, California. I don't know when it was, but it was before the 7:15 a.m. Sony announcement. So, there's a lot going on, a lot to announce. And, you know, we might as well jump right into it because our top story is about Sony. Sony CEO Kazuo Hirai today unveiled three new phones and other Sony products at the company's IFA press conference. The most noteworthy part of the announcement, I think, was an industry-first 4K screen on a new Xperia Z5 premium smartphone. The company also announced a Z5 and a Z5 Compact. Kevin Toefel, 4K, I mean, come on. It's like that's kind of beyond ridiculous. Is even 2K ridiculous?
You know, I applaud Sony for pushing the envelope here, and they make fantastic televisions, and the Bravia engine from their TVs is in their smartphones and tablets. I'm not sold on 4K in a smartphone. Couple reasons. One, you know, what is that going to do to the battery life? That's a huge concern. I'd rather have a lower resolution screen that lasts me all day as opposed to a beautiful screen that is kind of useless when I have no battery life. Secondly, you know, 4K video really looks better on a bigger display. I just went shopping for a 4K TV, bought my first one about 2 weeks ago. You really want to go bigger, not smaller here. And again, I applaud what Sony's trying to do, but 5.5 inches of a 4K display, I mean, that's 806 pixels per inch, which is ridiculous. I haven't seen it, so I don't want to, you know, totally bash it, but I'm not getting it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. But their battery, in order to power that display with good battery life, is a 3430 milliamp per hour battery. It's ginormous, and I think it makes the phone a little heavy. They claim two days of battery life. So they claim to have better battery life than the competition. We'll see if that's in fact the case. It is a mystery why they do that. Sometimes I think that Sony phones are kind of like the kind of devices you build to sort of like teach the industry what's coming up in 2 years. You know, they're very advanced on lots of levels. You know, the camera is a 23 megapixel camera. They figured that the 20 megapixel or whatever it was in the last or current phone just wasn't enough megapixels. So let's throw a few more megapixels in there. They're also claiming a super fast autofocus, the fastest autofocus in the smartphone universe, and great low light photography. They can claim this stuff all day long. The proof is in the pudding, and we'll be reviewing this stuff, and you will too. Everybody will be reviewing this phone, so we'll see how they actually perform under real world conditions. But again, 4K a 4K screen, I'm just so confused by that. I don't even know what that, like, I would love to have some scientific evidence about what the maximum resolution is that the human eye can discern at the distance of a foot or something like that. So we can have some real information about whether these kinds of things, you know, the camera is part of the same thing. They want to crank up the numbers, megapixel is another one. Apple has a great camera, you know, great 8-megapixel cameras. There doesn't seem to be, you know, above 8 megapixels, there doesn't seem to be a super strong correlation between the number of megapixels and the quality of the photos. So I just don't know what these numbers mean.
Yeah, I mean, I'm okay with the 23-megapixel camera. I mean, that kind of goes hand-in-hand with a 4K TV because that's a beautiful palette to look at these awesome photos. And quite honestly, Sony makes some of the best camera sensors in the industry. iPhones and other devices actually use the Sony camera sensors in their phones.
Yeah.
You wouldn't know that except for the teardowns and such. But, you know, I've never had a problem with the Sony cameras, and I'm fine with them pushing the envelope on the 23 megapixels, which I believe is exclusive to their own phones, at least for the time being. But I'm still leery on the whole battery life thing with that display and the GPU. Bear in mind, this is going to use the Snapdragon 810 processor, which there have been reports of not so great battery life, overheating issues, and so on. And hopefully those are all resolved, but, you know, again, a great display in a phone is useless if there's no juice in the phone. So,
and it was kind of funny, I thought, almost a faux pas by Hirai, who basically made it clear. He basically kind of said, yeah, these phones have a camera in them that has electronics that's better than the ones we sell to the partners upon which our entire company depends right now. So it's a good thing they have no market share, because that would have been, imagine if they were Sony. I mean, if they were Samsung, you know, heavily competing for the actual handset market in major markets all over the world, and said, yeah, we make the sensors for everybody, and the one that's in our camera is better than the ones we sell to those other people, and they might be looking for another supplier. That was kind of a funny moment. There's some other interesting aspects to these phones, one of which is that the fingerprint sensor is basically built into the power button. The power button doesn't look like a fingerprint sensor at all. It just looks like a regular power button, but when you're touching it, it's a fingerprint sensor, which I thought was pretty cool. I guess the thing that's coolest about it is that you typically see the little slot type, which you have to scrape your finger across, or you see the Apple iPhone type, which is a big flat piece of sapphire. And you put your thumb on, hold it. This one apparently functions like the Apple one, but it looks like a piece of metal. I've never seen a fingerprint sensor like this, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, and it's interesting because Sony's design has always had the iconic power button on the side of their Xperia phones. It's been a small round power button. Now it's oblong to accommodate the fingerprint sensor. And you don't, as you've said, and we can see in video, you don't have to swipe your thumb or anything like that. It's just right there. It's right where your thumb would be anyway. And you just place it on there. So I think that's a good design choice on their part. I'm probably more interested in the other two phones that come along with the Z5, because Sony has typically made smaller phones that don't have all the flagship features, but they do have a 4.6 inch Z5 compact with a 720p display, but still has all of the same capabilities as the larger premium device. And then they've got that middle of the road one too, the basic Xperia Z5.
Yeah, one other feature that I think is really interesting is that they're waterproof. So they don't have they don't have a cap. You don't have to put a little rubber thing into the power, you know, jack. It's waterproof. The water goes into that jack, and it doesn't affect the phone somehow. I do wonder what it's like, you know, to go into the ocean, come out with a wet phone, and then plug it in. I wonder what happens there. I'm sure we'll find out on YouTube at some point, but. That is an interesting feature. They're always really good with waterproofing their phones.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Now, Sony also announced the addition of HDR support for a bunch of Bravia TV sets, which is really interesting. And they went on and on about how great that is and how that improves some of the HDR content that's out there. I don't know if you had any comment on the idea of HDR in a TV set. I mean, they're taking a... I thought it was interesting that they're taking a concept associated with TVs, 4K, and putting it in their phone, and they're taking a concept associated with smartphones or cameras, which is HDR, and putting it in their TV. But anyway, what did you think about HDR on the TV?
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, this is actually, to me, a much bigger step up than 4K TV, because more pixels is great. But when you can start changing the range of contrast and brightness and so on, you know, throughout the picture instead of all at once... And that's going to happen not just on Sony TVs, but I presume across the industry over the next 1 to 2 years. Now you get a much nicer viewing experience. You know, we've seen it before with our photos, you know, getting those HDR photos where they just look so much nicer. The colors pop, the right colors pop. And, you know, that's ideal on a TV set. And again, the industry has been talking about this, so it's nice to see Sony actually implementing it right now.
And of course, they announced a couple of new Walkmans, a big one and a small one. They're under the Hear brand. They have terrible names. The Hear NW-A25HN. That's as good of a name as the iPod, Sony. And a bunch of headphones to go with it. And they, you know, they spent the time when they were talking about the Walkman products, not talking about how great the devices were, but how you should like what they call high resolution audio. It was a big pitch for the concept of high quality music. It must be frustrating to a company like Sony that they have to devote their sales pitch to convincing people that better sounding music is better.
Yeah, and Sony's actually been pushing this more so than I think anybody else over the past 2 years, high-res audio. We've heard about the Pono player and some of the other audio players that do high-res audio. I actually bought one of the high-res audio Walkmans a couple months back, purchased some high-resolution audio files. They're massively large, obviously. You don't get the compression that you would have from an MP3, for example. And they did sound better. The question is, will people repurchase their music and pay more for it? Because those files are not cheap. They're much more expensive, typically. An album will cost you about $20. Plus, there's also streaming services such as Tidal that have high-res audio streaming. And, you know, some people's ears can hear it, some people's can't. So I don't really see how Sony can do anything but try and push that, because it's an experience that they're pushing and trying to sell, not so much the device at this point.
Yeah, it's really an interesting concept what Sony's trying to do. They keep doing the same sorts of things. They have very high quality products, but they don't have a mid-range where they can actually make money on the reputation that's been created by the high-end products. I mean, this is kind of the car model. Like, every car company has the little super high-end car, and then you're like, oh, I'm driving a Mercedes, and you're like, you have the junky Mercedes, but like, it has an aura, a halo effect because of the higher end cars. That might not be a good example, but you see what I'm saying? Like, you know, the Samsungs of the world, you know, people can walk around and say, oh, I have a Samsung smartphone, and people are thinking, wow, it's a Samsung, you know, the latest model. It's got edge with the high, super high resolution, this and the best camera in the world and all this stuff. But no, you have the mid-range Samsung, but there's a halo effect there. Sony has nothing for the mass market. As far as I can tell.
They had it and they lost it. I mean, they were a leader in consumer electronics for years between televisions and high-end stereo equipment. And you can still spend, I already looked, $2,000 on a high-res audio component for your stereo system from Sony. But they do have that $299 Walkman as well, which is the one I bought. So they're trying to get the price points down into the mass market. And it's been tough. They've been disrupted, quite honestly. The smartphones have disrupted them. It's one of the reasons I got rid of the Walkman, because the Sony phones and many other phones now start playing the high-res audio files. So why do I need a $300 portable audio player that does nothing when my phone can do the same thing and more?
Exactly. Well, we got some more news for you coming right up. Some really, really interesting news about Apple TV and other things. But first, let's talk about Intel. Intel's one of our sponsors today. And of course, if you've ever bought a powerful, flexible 2-in-1, it's powered by Intel. Intel's the driving force behind this technology. And it's great stuff, especially for small businesses. If you've got a small business and you're trying to decide what sort of clients to get your employees, it's a tough call. Do you get tablets, which have all kinds of benefits for flexibility, a certain amount of mobility, and the touch interface and all the other benefits of tablets? Or do you go for the power of laptops with their fully functional keyboards and touchpads and all the rest? With Intel-powered 2-in-1s, of course, you don't have to make that choice. You can have either, depending on what the situation is. And there's so many different variations for how you can approach this great model of computing. There are devices backed by Intel powered 2-in-1s that are good stylus input. There are others that have the keyboard that flips around and goes on the back. So no matter where you go with this tablet, looks like you have a tablet, feels like you have a tablet, but whoops, you got to type something, flip it around, and you got a full size keyboard. It's just a great way to go, especially for small businesses. And of course, fifth generation Intel Core processors run applications fast. They run long on battery. They get the most out of the batteries that you have. And their Intel Core M processors give you razor thin tablets and ultra fast laptops all in the same device. And of course, their wireless technology is second to none. Experience the power of and. Visit smallbusiness.intel.com and find out how Intel Power 2-in-1s can improve your small business. That's smallbusiness.intel.com. And we thank Intel for their support of Tech News Today. A federal judge has greenlit a class action lawsuit by three Uber drivers. The case could affect up to 160,000 Uber drivers in California who could sue for up to $51 billion. The foundation of the case is also the foundation of the sharing economy. They're suing to be retroactively reclassified as employees of Uber rather than independent contractors. Doug McMillon is a tech reporter for The Wall Street Journal and joins us to talk about it. Welcome to the show, Doug.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Thanks for coming on. Now, on what basis has the judge granted this suit? I mean, driving for Uber has costs and benefits that everybody knows. The cost is that you're on your own. You don't get health insurance and all the things that you get when you're an employee of a company. And the benefits are also well known. You get extreme work time flexibility. You can work whenever you want. And these employees who would potentially be part of this lawsuit have presumably weighed the options. They've chosen to drive for Uber. They've enjoyed the benefits of driving for Uber. And now, in retroactively, they want to change that bargain after the fact. So what is their case? What is their legal case that could justify this class action going forward?
Yeah, so one thing that's important to bear in mind with today's news is this is the very preliminary stage of this lawsuit. And really what's happened yesterday with the federal judge granted class certification to a select number of Uber drivers in California, but did not really yet weigh on whether or not the merits of the case will, you know, what will happen in the outcome, whether or not Uber drivers will eventually be determined to be employees or independent contractors. Basically, what this U.S. Northern District Judge Chen allowed to go forward is several thousand Uber drivers now can become part of this class action to become part of this lawsuit. The lawyer that's representing them now has her work cut out for her because she's going to have to, as you say, kind of make the very difficult case that people who have signed up to work for Uber as independent contractors, in fact, were being controlled by Ubers in various ways, that their job looked more like an employer-employee relationship than an independent contractor relationship. It's a very difficult thing to prove. But it's, you know, not without precedent. There have been other cases and other companies that have proven that people who signed up to work as independent contractors were, in fact, being more kind of treated as employees.
So, Doug, it's obviously very early to even think about what may or may not happen here. But $51 billion is not chump change. Plus, this could totally disrupt Uber's core line of business. What happens if they win in a worst case or best case if you're the drivers? What happens here? I mean, what are the impacts to Uber? What happens to their entire business model?
Yeah, I want to clarify one thing in Mike's intro. The $51 billion is actually how much Uber is worth right now. It's been valued by private investors. That's not what anyone is seeking. And in fact, we don't know how much potentially, you know, the monetary damages could result in this case. But like you said, there are very potentially high financial stakes here. Uber has really gotten that valuation and attracted so many investors and gains, you know, so much momentum in its business because it bills itself as this technology platform. Instead of being a taxi company where it owns the cars and it employs the drivers and all of the costs that entails, Uber essentially, you know, bills itself as just kind of a matchmaker between a passenger and a driver. And that has allowed it to kind of keep its costs very low and expand very rapidly to dozens of cities around the world. If Uber is going to have to eventually reclassify, if this case wins and Uber eventually has to reclassify some or all of its drivers as employees, it may have to incur new costs such as paying for their health insurance, paying workers' compensation, paying for their work expenses like gasoline and tolls and car repairs. So there are kind of a bevy of new costs that Uber would be saddled with that, you know, would potentially definitely change Uber's business model. We don't know how that would look in the end. Potentially, people have said that Uber would potentially pass that cost back onto its customers. So, you know, those low price rides that you enjoy around town that cost, you know, $10 may eventually cost, you know, $15 or more because Uber is going to have to be an expensive, more expensive business model. That's if kind of this case comes to bear.
Now, there was another case in California that reclassified a single employee as a single Uber driver as an employee. So they essentially got the status that this class action is seeking, theoretically. What happened in that case and how does that bear on the class action?
Yeah, so that was, as you said, a single driver. And really what that rested on was the plaintiff proving that Uber controls so many different aspects of a driver's experience, from setting the fares, from various expectations around what kind of car they can drive, and how they interact with the app and how they even interact with customers, that the totality of the many different ways Uber controls its drivers really is proof in and of itself that is an employer-employee relationship and not an independent contract relationship. So while the outcome of that particular case was not officially a precedent-setting case, as you say, it only pertained to one driver, I think that, you know, part of the framework or the kind of the gist of how that case was won and how it was proven might provide kind of a backbone or a framework by which the plaintiff in this new class action suit could try to make her case. Basically, she's going to prove that the totality of the experience around a driver's, whole experience of getting in the car, picking up their passengers, and paying Uber and working out the price of the ride with Uber could potentially amount to an employer-employee relationship.
Doug, one thing that would change this this whole scenario is something that I think Uber is looking into. Back in February, it was reported that they were working in a Pittsburgh lab with Carnegie Mellon about self-driving cars, their own self-driving cars. Do you think that's the answer for them? That's their long-term strategy and the reason they're trying to do the whole self-driving car thing?
I think that is more, at this point, a hedge than anything. The self-driving car story has become a very fascinating one for our readers and your viewers, I'm sure. And I think there's a lot of interesting companies kind of approaching that. But I don't think that anyone thinks that there are going to be self-driving cars on the road, you know, in the very near future, and certainly not soon enough to for Uber to start planning any significant changes to its business model.
Okay, just to interrupt you there, Doug, how does the timeline of self-driving cars match up with the timeline of a class action lawsuit like this, assuming it goes to Supreme Court?
I've heard people estimating that this class action case could take years. I don't think, I've heard basically people estimating that self-driving cars could take decades. So I think probably the class action thing is likely to be settled before that. But that's an interesting question to think about.
All right. Well, Doug McMillan is at WSJ.com and on Twitter at DMAC1. Doug, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me, guys.
All right. Great picture of Wall Street behind him, or presumably downtown New York City. Well, major tech companies are partnering to improve online video. Companies like Cisco, Microsoft, Google, Intel, Mozilla, Amazon, and Netflix are all banding together in a new organization called the Alliance for Open Media. Apple, Sony, Adobe, Facebook, Twitter, Roku, Vimeo, and Hulu are not part of the alliance. The goal of this Alliance for Open Media is to create better video compression technology within the next couple of years, Kevin Toefel. It always freaks me out when there are major, major companies. I mean, you would think that companies like Apple, Sony, and Facebook, and not to mention Vimeo and Hulu, you'd think that they'd be super interested in a new standard for compressing video that doesn't have the licensing fees. I mean, MPEG LA patent licensing fees and other issues around the current standards or the standards that are teed up to become the next standards. Are you nervous that these other companies aren't involved in this and that they may form either a competing standard or just reject it or oppose it?
I'm not too concerned. I mean, each one of those that are not part of this Alliance for Open Media, they've worked on their own technologies in the past. I remember when Apple came out with the adaptive bitrate streaming. So, you know, they're all doing their own thing. What's interesting to me here is that Google actually got away from the whole MPEG licensing thing with its VP8 codec back in 2012, and they've since had VP9, VP10. Microsoft wanted no part of that, so it wasn't part of Internet Explorer, wasn't supported. And yet now, Microsoft is part of this with Google. So something has changed in the conversation. I don't know if that's a Satya Nadella thing as the CEO of Microsoft that says we need to be working with these folks or what, but that's a big about change from what happened a few years back.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Well, we'll see where that goes. And they actually have a pretty aggressive timeline. I mean, I think they're looking at the end of 2017. As the time when this is rolled out in the real world. We told you yesterday about a 9-to-5 Mac report on next week's announcement of an all-new Apple TV. The story said the next Apple TV will be gaming-focused with a new Siri-centric remote that also has an integrated touchpad. Sounds kind of complicated. We'll see how simple and Apple-y it is. Today, though, another exclusive on 9-to-5 Mac exposes the hardware inside the next Apple TV, and I think, Kevin, that one of the biggest shockers here is the fact that, unlike Sony's phone, the Apple TV will not support 4K.
Well, you know, if you look at Apple and their product development lifecycle, they typically don't lead off with the cutting edge technologies. They usually wait until there's enough of a mass market audience to take advantage of it. And I mean, 4K TV prices have come way down, but still, there are a lot of 1080p sets, even some 720p sets out there. So I'm not terribly surprised that Apple isn't planning to put 4K support into the new Apple TV. I mean, this is a report. We don't know yet what's going to happen, but I won't be too shocked if it's not there. I wish it was, because I have a TV set that could take advantage of it, but I'm not thinking they're going to do this just yet.
So let's rattle off some of the other facts in this report. And some of these were also separately reported by BuzzFeed, but 9to5 Mac had all the BuzzFeed facts plus a lot more. So the current Apple TV has 8 gigs of storage, and the next all-new Apple TV will have 8 gigabytes of storage for one model. That's $149. And then there'll be a 16 gig model for $199. And the idea for not increasing the storage, as you might expect, is that everything will be streamed from the internet, nothing stored locally. For the most part, that storage is for apps. Now, they're going to have the same A chip that's found in the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, according to this report. And the remote that we talked about before, which again is Siri focused, you talk into the remote, talk to Siri in the remote, and also it has an integrated touchpad, will also have tactile buttons for Siri and the home button, and also rocker buttons assumed by the author of this piece to control volume levels. It'll have the same ports as the current Apple TV, and it'll have a proactive universal search. Now, this is the thing that BuzzFeed reported, which what this means is that you say, okay, I want to watch, you know, Godzilla, and you type in Godzilla and then say, well, here's Godzilla on iTunes, here's Godzilla on Hulu, here's Godzilla and all these sources that you have access to. And you're just like, I want to play the one on Netflix. And you click that and it streams from Netflix to through your Apple TV. That's something that was rumored as early as March. This is a confirmed by unnamed sources type of report. The difference between the BuzzFeed and the 9to5 Mac report is that 9to5 Mac says that Apple may wait on this feature. It'll be in there. It'll be supported. But they may wait until there's a lot more content out there before they throw the switch and say, okay, this universal search is there. So that those are the facts. If this is what they're going to announce, Kevin, is this a disappointing announcement?
I'm sure some will be disappointed. Some people always are. It doesn't matter. You can't please them. But, you know, what Apple's doing here is setting itself up for a new or an expanded platform on the TV. There's talk of apps for this Apple TV. And as you said, you know, they may wait on this because there might not be a lot of apps at launch. Developers don't have an SDK that I know of to start making Apple TV apps. So they could put the hardware out there now. And yeah, some people may just be disappointed that you can't play games on it just yet, but give it to 3 months maybe, and you'll start to see developers glom on, and there'll be a lot of content and things to do, is probably what Apple's thinking here.
Yeah, and they'll be dazzling people with all the gaming stuff. You'll be able to use a third-party Bluetooth controller, or you'll be able to use the remote control, which can have sensors in it and a touchpad, as a controller for different types of gamings. And these, no doubt, will not be hardcore Call of Duty type of games. They'll probably be more casual gaming. But again, who knows? We'll see. And there'll be lots of content there. We also know that the event is taking place a week from today in a venue that's twice the size of their previous biggest venue. It holds 7,000 people. There's lots of speculation about why they need so much capacity. And one idea is that, you know, they're talking about TV, and they're talking about gaming, and that's going to, this is my own theory, they're going to have lots of people from Hollywood, lots of people from the gaming industry. The kind of part, when you partner with Apple for an announcement like this, one of the bennies is you get to go to the event and watch Tim Cook in all his glory. And so that could be one explanation for all those chairs that are going to be in this venue. Well, the Asus announcement today revealed a new router. Yeah, a router. We're giving you a news report about a router. This new router is, according to Asus, the world's fastest. It's called the RTAC5300, and it's 67% faster than first-gen tri-band routers, according to the company. Asus says it can deliver up to 2.167 gigabits per second on each of the two 5 gigahertz bands. And that is very, very, very fast. It looks like something out of your worst science fiction-induced nightmares, though. It looks like a horrible, it's like alien spider from hell coming to get you. But if it delivers fast broadband, who cares? The company also announced a $129 PC on a stick that runs Windows 10, and that is called the Asus Vivo Stick. What do you think of this router? Is this? Do you think they'll be able to deliver on these promises? I mean, it sounds really fast.
I hope so, because I have an Asus router now that I've had for 2 years. It's been pretty good, but I'm maxing out on my home broadband. It's not pushing that signal all the way through the house right now. This thing looks like a futuristic octopus, and I hope that they can deliver on it, because I could use this speed. The question still remains, though, about price, and it looks like it's rumored to be $400, and I don't know that I want to spend $400 on a router. I mean, just get some access points instead.
Or two Google On Hubs. So, yeah, okay. Well, a new report from the analytics firm App Annie lists the most popular and profitable iOS apps, not of the year, but of all time. And here's what's one of the most interesting things about it. Four of the top 10 popular apps belong to Facebook, starting with the number one all-time most downloaded iOS app, which is the Facebook app. The second is Facebook Messenger, which Facebook forced everybody to use if they wanted to use Facebook Messenger on mobile. Instagram at number four, and WhatsApp at number six. So the complete list is Facebook, Facebook Messenger, YouTube, Instagram, Skype, WhatsApp, Messenger, Find My iPhone, Google Maps, Twitter, and iTunes U. The Find My iPhone and iTunes U are super surprising, I think.
Not at all. Apple, you know, puts out that little pop-up saying, hey, download these apps. These are essentials. Find My iPhone is one of those. Some of the other iOS apps from Apple are on there. Facebook is integrated into the settings of an iPhone, so that helps their cause as well. So it's they've helped push this along.
And I'm also learning from this story that, or from App Annie, that the big iTunes U numbers are bolstered by big downloads in China, which I didn't know that. So in terms of making money, they have other lists as well. One of them is how much money, you know, listing the apps in terms of how much money they made. The top 10 list is completely off the wall and unpredicted. I wouldn't have predicted it anyway. Here they are in order. Pandora Radio, okay. Line, which, you know, is huge in Japan, but like not huge globally, I thought. Zusk, right? Did you download Zusk? Not me. Nope. Pages, Apple's own, you know, word processing application. Spotify, that makes sense. Badu, Skype, okay, I get it. Major League Baseball, MLB.com at bat, okay. Grindr, which is a gay dating app, and Line Play. So take it from me, folks. If you want to make money in the app business, get into the gay dating racket. Grindr,
it's all in-app purchases for a lot of these things. I mean,
what are they buying?
MLB.com, that's a subscription. You know, Skype, you might be buying Skype credits. Spotify, you're buying your subscription through Apple and paying Apple's making 30% off that. When Spotify, you can go direct and Spotify get the money. That's what it is. It's all in-app purchases and subscriptions, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And this is a great way to, for those of us in the U.S. and Europe, to shock ourselves into realizing and detecting the larger world out there. If you were to ask any astute observer, even, of the mobile, you know, app scene in the United States, whether Line would have two spots in the most revenue harvesting apps, they probably wouldn't believe you. But there it is. Unbelievable. Well, Google made a couple of changes to ads yesterday. They rolled out a new Gmail ad format that allows for native ads. And if you're slapping your forehead and saying, what's a native ad in email? The format delivers ads that look and function like regular emails. For example, they can be forwarded in case you want to forward that ad to your friends. They'll love you for it. Or if they're saved to the inbox. They'll also appear in both mobile and browser versions of Gmail. Google's been testing the format for 2 years. Kevin Toefel, you're shaking your head. Sounds like you are going to be a big fan of this.
Not a fan at all. Don't mess with my inbox, honestly. I'm fine with seeing ads on the side or wherever else, but I don't want to see ads that are appearing as messages in my inbox. I don't want to forward them. I don't want to see them. I mean, I know Google's been testing this format. I hope they've asked for user feedback, and I have to bet that by and large, it's been negative.
I bet you're right, and I'm the same. I'm with you, Kevin. My inbox is sacred territory, and I go to great lengths to make sure that my inbox. I'm a zero inbox kind of guy. I have 700 rules or filters, whatever they call them in Gmail. My basic philosophy about email is that every single thing in my inbox is a problem that needs to be solved. How do I prevent this from ever coming into my inbox again? And I go to my inbox, I literally have zero inbox, maintain it all the time. And if I am in this pristine state and an ad shows up, I'm not going to be happy. Well, we'll see what happens. Well, the other change is that Google plans to start demoting mobile pop-up install ads. That's where the ad wants you to download an app. Starting after November 1st, pages that show full-page app install ads will be considered mobile unfriendly, and therefore those pages will be demoted in search results. The mobile-geddon continues, Kevin Toefel.
Yeah, I have less of a problem with this. I mean, in iOS, if you go to a website that has an app, you'll get a little banner, I guess, at the top of the site that says, hey, you can install this from the App Store. It's the same concept to me, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah, me too. It's probably a good thing. Well, we got some really interesting news from a restaurant in San Francisco coming right up. But first, let's talk about food you can make in your own house. Blue Apron is one of our sponsors today, and I want to talk about this. You see that? If you're watching the video version, you'll see that I'm holding this beautiful, full-color, beautifully photographed instruction thing that comes with Blue Apron. Each box for Blue Apron comes with three of these because there's three meals in there. And I want to just show you what's so great about this. And I'm going to tell you at the end of this spot how you can get two free meals from Blue Apron. And you're going to want this. So here's a perfect example. At the top of this, this is a seared steak recipe with Romesco sauce and roasted potatoes. Now, they go into some summary detail about the origin of this sauce. It originated in northeastern Spain, you know, Catalonia, and it's traditionally associated with fish. In recent years, people have been using it with meat and that sort of thing. And so it's a little background on what you're going to be eating, and then it shows you exactly what the ingredients are, and they're listed. So you can pull those out of the box and get them ready to go. And then look at these simple instructions. They are so clear and simple, and they make fantastic use of photography. They show you exactly, and this isn't like, you know, one of those food ads where the photos of the food looks different from what you're actually getting. This is exactly what the stuff looks like. Exactly. And so you can line it up just like this. It tells you how to process it. And this is one of the things that I love about Blue Apron recipes is they're super efficient. So you notice here that you're roasting two vaguely related parts of the meal at the same time, at the same temperature, on the same cookie sheet there. And then you take it out, you do this step, you go to this next, you chop it up, you put it there, and then you put it together and you plate it. And when you're done, it's supposed to look like this. And let me tell you something, it's going to look just like that. This is what's so great about Blue Apron. Their instructions are what you see is what you're actually going to get. So let me show you what the box looks like, if you can give me the overhead. And this is the box You're looking down in there. It's a box with all the ingredients you need. This is fresh, seasonal ingredients. There's some corn for you. And yeah, you're going to do, you're going to wash it. You're going to chop it. You're going to do all the work necessary in the process. You're going to learn how to make fantastic, delicious food, not just with Blue Apron, but it'll teach you how to be a better chef, a better cook. And you'll start right off the bat with fantastic, fantastic meals with Blue Apron. I love their food. Blue Apron is simply a better way to cook. Check out this week's menu and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's right. Two free meals just for going to blueapron.com/twit. And those meals will come with these recipes, you know, the recipes, step-by-step instructions. They're not recipes. They're so much better than recipes. It's free. Two meals free. And we thank Blue Apron for their support of Tech News Today. Well, in news you can lose, a new restaurant in San Francisco called Itza replaces the waiters with iPads. Restaurant customers place their order and pay with an iPad. And then when the food's ready, it appears in a numbered cube, which is covered by a transparent display. When the order is ready, the customer's name appears in the otherwise clear glass. And at no point in the dining process does any customer have to make contact with any other human who works at the restaurant. Everything on the menu is organic, vegetarian, and costs $6.95. The company was founded by Scott Drummond and Tim Young. Drummond, if you recall, is the former CEO of a big data startup called Autonomy, which was sold to HP 4 years ago for about $10 billion. Eats is planning two more restaurants, one in L.A. and another in San Francisco. Kevin Toefel, what do you think about this? I mean, this is great for shy people who don't like to make human contact. But is there enough of us around to make this a viable business?
Well, shy people can just use takeout or delivery. I appreciate what they're trying to do here with Itza, but you know, there's something to the dining experience, at least in my belief, that you know, there's an interaction, there's an experience, there's ambiance, and so on. If you're going out to eat, and the wait staff is part of that, that could make or break your entire meal. So I'm not a fan. I don't think I would even try it. I mean, it just sounds a little too impersonal for me.
It's almost, you know, you know, the next step is that each one of those little cubbies is going to be a 3D food printer. And it's going to be Star Trek, right? Girl, great tea. And then you get, you know, you lift up the thing and you pull it out.
Food replicators. Yeah,
exactly. So it's fascinating. I can't wait to go there and try it. Interestingly, all of the, you know, almost all the foods are salads and almost all of them are quinoa based. So I don't know how this would play in Peoria, but in San Francisco and L.A., I'm sure the food part of it is not a problem because lots of people like that kind of stuff. I like that kind of stuff as well. So very interesting. And I think a lot of the technology is actually behind the scenes. So with the app and how it works with the back end database and deals with inventory and all the rest, it's all pretty flexible in real time. Maybe I'll have to do a hands-on review of this stuff, or maybe fork on, or whatever you call it when you eat a salad, and do a review. Well, our TNT fan of the day is Phil, the P2 geek in Lansing, Michigan, who posted this picture on Twitter. It shows Phil's workspace. He's the comics.community podcast host and an instructional designer. And like so many of our audience, he's got way, way too many monitors on his desk. Very cool. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. And use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT so we can find it. Kevin Toefel, what are you working on these days? Are you digging into the Sony news, or are you dealing with other IFA-related events?
This has been such a busy week between IFA. Yesterday was even busier for me. I was in New York City at my first time to Google's headquarters there. So I got my free breakfast in their cafe, which was amazing. Unbelievable. I can't even describe it. I was in shock and awe just figuring out what I was going to eat. I'm digesting the Sony news. And I also did finally get from the Samsung test drive, I got the Galaxy S6 Edge Plus, which hopefully they don't add anything more to it because the name's getting too long. Ironically, as nice as the screen is, the curve actually feels better in my hand this way.
Yeah.
but you really can't use the phone that way. So, yeah. So, but this is what I'll be testing in the next week over at ZDNet.
Yeah. Awesome. Very, very cool. Yeah, I've been to... surprisingly, I've only been to two Google headquarters, one of which, of course, is the Googleplex in Mountain View, California, which has a giant dinosaur statue and stuff like that. And the other one was this in Istanbul, Turkey. And let me tell you, I don't know how they did it, but they have like the fastest internet connection I've ever seen. in Istanbul. So that was pretty awesome. Unfortunately, it took me an hour through rush hour traffic to get to that from like 2 miles away or something like that. But yeah, very cool. All right, Kevin Toefel, well, thank you so much for co-anchoring, and we'll see you next time.
Sounds great. Thanks.
All right, bye-bye. You can subscribe to Tech News Today on YouTube. Just go to YouTube, search for Tech News Today, and subscribe right there with the giant subscribe button. You can choose your favorite way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. If you'd like to help us grow our audience, here's how you can do it. Just post a link to twit.tv/TNT on the social media site of your choice, tag three friends, and recommend that they subscribe. You can also join our Google Plus community. Just go to the community area on Google Plus, search for Tech News Today, and you'll find us right there. And you can follow me at Elgin.com. Don't miss our other news show, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific every single weeknight. And that is the Tech News Today. This show was produced by Jason Cleanthes and edited by Anthony Nielsen. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.